Welcome to Below the Line, where we talk about working in Hollywood from the crew perspective. My name is Skid. I'm a former assistant director and your host. Today we're talking about Before I Change My Mind, a Canadian coming-of-age indie film that ran theatrically in the U.S. last month, will be released in Canadian theaters on April 19th, so next weekend, and is now available digitally VOD in the U.S., and soon will be available in Canada. My guest is the writer-director, Trevor Anderson. Trevor, welcome to Below the Line.
Hi, Skid. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. This is going to be a fun film to talk about. A quick note for listeners, considering that the film's availability has been limited to date, today's conversation will be light on spoilers, but they are possible, so consider this a warning. With that in mind, Trevor, what else do we want people to know about this film before we dive in?
Everybody dies at the end. No, I'm kidding. No, yeah, it's not a very spoiler. I don't think we have to worry too much about spoilers with this one. As you say, it's a coming of age movie. The quick pitch is it's 1987. It's set in the Canadian prairies, which for your American listeners, you can think of as being right above Montana. And a new kid arrives at school, middle school, junior high school. Nobody can tell if the new kid, Robin, is a boy or a girl. And while they're all trying to figure that out, Robin falls in with the school bully and starts making increasingly dangerous choices to get popular or to fit in, I'll say.
Well, Trevor, thanks for summarizing. I really enjoyed the film, but I want to hear more about your background and how this film came about.
Right. I started in theater. I was a musical theater kid in Red Deer, Alberta, and community theater. And then I went to college and studied acting. After college, I transferred to the U of A, which is the University of Alberta in Edmonton, and I studied theater. And then I worked in Edmonton in the professional theater for about a decade. Edmonton is a really good theater town. So I was writing and directing and producing and very occasionally acting. I got more interested in behind-the-scenes stuff in the live theater in Edmonton. And then I got interested in film. And so I thought, oh, maybe I should go back and do a master's in film somewhere. And I started to look into it, and I saw that for the application portfolios, you pretty much universally had to have at least a short film to show them to get into a graduate film program. So, you know, I went down to the local film co-op in Edmonton, which is the Film and Video Association, which abbreviates to FABA. And, you know, I walked in and I said, I don't know even what my questions are, but I have a feeling that this would be the place I would go to figure out what my questions are and then figure out what the answers are to those questions to figure out how to begin to make a short film. And they were really generous with me, you know, a grassroots community-based co-op. And I made my first short film, and I liked it so much that I made another short film and another, and then I just kept making short films and I never went to film school. Short films became my film school.
No knock on people that do choose the film school path.
Yeah.
But in doing these short films, you learn so much about it. And that then led to, Before I Change Your Mind, your feature-length film debut. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I made about 12 short films. And then finally, we made this feature film, Before I Change My Mind. My writing partner, Fish Grakowski, and I started writing it in, I guess, 2016. And then we were supposed to shoot it in summer of 2020, but we all know what happened. So we delayed by a year, which was actually good. It gave us time to audition more carefully, more broadly, more slowly, which really helped us find this amazing cast of young actors. We had such great kids in this show. I was so proud and pleased. Yeah, and then, as you say, the film had its world premiere at the Locarno Film Festival in August of 2022, because we shot it in the summer of 21. And it's been on the festival circuit, and now it's in theater. So it's really been almost a 10-year journey. I guess I wrote the first story outline in 2015, and here it is 2024, I'm told.
Well, Trevor, I want to hear more about how your extensive background in theater, how you applied it to the approach of filmmaking, both when you started with your shorts and then how it informs Before I Change My Mind.
Well, coming from the theater, I was really used to actors and really, I think There are probably two different kinds of directors in the world of film, the kind that come up through cameras and are afraid of actors, or the kind who come up through, working with actors and are afraid of cameras. And I was certainly in the latter group. I was used to story, I was used to dramatic storytelling, I was used to directing actors, working with actors, I was used to an audience and how to shape a story for an audience's consumption. I was used to these things. Text, working with text, these were all things that I had a lot of fun with. Writing my own stories, generating my own material. And then when it came time to move into short films, what I did was I really carefully hired the crew and said to them, I want you to do two jobs on this. This is my first ever film, and I need you to do two jobs. I need you to do your normal job. So let's say I'm talking to the cinematographer. I need you to be the cinematographer. But then I also need you to teach me what a cinematographer needs from a director. So do your job, but teach me how to give you what you need from me. So, and I said that to everybody. I said, I have no idea what a script supervisor does, but I would like to be the kind of director who can communicate effectively with the script supervisor. I see the job of the director as being the person who has the information that then everybody needs a little bit of to go and be able to do their jobs. And I wanted to learn from the people who need the information how to give them that information. And fortunately, Edmonton it's just the right size. It's big enough that there's people making these independent films, but not so big that they're not going to respond favorably to a request like that. People, I think, were happy to get it on the ground floor, and maybe they saw it as an opportunity to break a director of some bad habits, to get in early. And so I'm really indebted to the crew of the first short films who, not only did their job, but taught me how to do mine.
And so by the time you come to Before I Change My Mind, feature length, have you surrounded yourself with, dare I say, film professionals at this point? Or is there more about your theater background that is evident in this specific film?
Well, because Edmonton is such a strong theater town, we were actually able to pull a lot of certainly the art department. We can start there. It's 1987, and we had a very low budget. So actually, the first big picture thing I should say is that this movie only exists because of the goodwill of the crew. We had about a half a million American to make this movie, and in the end, I hope it looks like about a $2 million picture, which is about what we should have had, and I would have liked to have had. But because we didn't, it was down to the crew, who said, yeah, we can do it. We want to do it. We're going to do it. Let's do it. And it's this, what people call the sweat equity of the crew that is made up the financial shortfall. So it's the producers and the crew who really put this over the finish line. And the art department especially did a lot of the heavy lifting to make it 1987.
Point out, you're taking a period piece. Yes, you don't have a cell phone budget because people don't have the cell phones to run around, but everything else has got to look like, oh my God, I'm afraid to do the math. 35 years ago? Oh my goodness, are we that
Don't
old
even.
now?
I know. I mean, we wrote, my writing partner Fish and I wrote a lot of it to be outdoors in the woods because trees are trees. But the costumes did a lot of the work. And the costume designer is an old friend of mine named Leona Brausen, and she's like a great theater wardrobe designer, costume designer in Edmonton. Legendary in the theater, like a vet, a pro, an icon, dare I say. And she's got a huge personal collection of vintage clothes from, any era you want to say in the 20th century, any decade you want to say, she's got it. And she's got an eye for it. So she also knows how to just make a run to the secondhand shop and get it right on a dime. So having Leona doing the costumes was crucial to getting the period right. I show up in the movie. I have a small secondary role as the community theater director, kind of a parody of my own self as the director. I'm playing this community theater impresario, very flamboyant, and Everything I wear in the movie is an actual outfit that Leona herself wore when she lived in New York in the 80s.
Perfect.
Yeah. And then the production designer was a young graduate of the theater design program at the University of Alberta. Her name's Brianna Kolibaba. And she's, I think she was fresh out of the gate. She, I think, had done, she'd done a lot of theater and a lot of opera already, even as a recent graduate. I think she had done one like micro budget film before us, just before us. And so she, I interviewed her and just had a really good instinct. There was a bit of concern because, she wasn't alive in the 80s, but a proper designer like her, she could do her research. And maybe because she wasn't alive in the 80s and was relying on solid research, she got a lot of details right that those of us who were around in the 80s would look at things and say, "Oh my gosh, I remember this. I'd forgotten about this." And she wasn't just working from a vague sense of, "Oh yeah, I remember the 80s." She was being very specific and very diligent about her work. So again, without the proper resources to support her, other than the goodwill of the crew surrounding her and her staff, and the producers really did everything they could to make sure she had what she needed. But really, it was her talent and her dedication that got us the 80s on a shoestring. And in a way that I'm so proud of and so pleased with, because she's the kind of designer who, Robin, our hero, has a single dad, and the two of them together move to this new town, and they have to furnish an apartment from scratch from the thrift store. So it's not going to look like 1987. It's going to look like the 70s. And she's the kind of designer who knows that. But then, there's kind of a rich kid, Izzy, and we go over to her single mom's house, and she's a realtor, and she's all about surfaces and all about presentation. And so she'd have the newest, trendiest everything. So her house was the 1980s showroom. The living room looked like a lamp store, and it was perfect for the character, So she's really designing, Brianna and Leona are both really designing character first.
Trevor, I want to go deeper into the play within the play that you mentioned. Talking about the idea about how this comes together, it's really a centerpiece of the story, and I want to hear more about what went into it.
Yeah, so within the movie, our kids get conscripted into the community theater production. It's supposed to be Jesus Christ Superstar. The joke inside the movie is that I slash he, the character I play, Mr. Anderson, the director, couldn't get the rights to Jesus Christ Superstar. That's like already an in-joke because naively I thought we could just get the rights to Jesus Christ Superstar. My parents said, "Are you crazy?" And it became a gift because it was much funnier to have the character not be able to get the rights and therefore have written an original musical from Mary Magdalene's point of view. So we've got this satire in the middle, which is like a parody of Jesus Christ Superstar from, the Jesus's quote unquote girlfriend's point of view. And it works for the Andrew Lloyd Webber fans of the original Jesus Christ Superstar movie. I think it's funny for them as a satire. And then also for people who don't know the original musical, hopefully it just stands on its own as a ridiculous community theater musical that our heroes get pulled into being in the chorus of.
Yeah, well, they're saxophone-bearing centurions, I think, is
That's
what
right.
our heroes are, our student group is playing.
Yeah, I go to the band class and I say, "Who wants to be a centurion?" And one of the kids raises his hand and goes, were there saxophones in Jesus' time?" And I just say to him, "Yes. Yes, there were." And so it's that kind of thing. And it's also where we could push all the 1980s-ness, because I had this sort of rule of thumb for the designers, which was no Rubik's cubes. In so many 80s movies, you're going to start on a close-up of a Rubik's cube, and then it's going to be on the bedside table of the hero, and you're going to, pan across to the hero waking up in bed. How many times have we seen that to say 80s? And so I had this rule, which is like, go a little further, be a little more subtle. I don't want to see any Rubik's cubes, except you can push all of that into the stage musical, because whereas Jesus Christ Superstar was very 70s influenced, we wanted Mary Magdalene Video Star to be like an 80s MTV Cyndi Lauper kind of influence, to the point that my writing partner Fish the co-author of the movie gets dressed up as a giant Rubik's cube when we're taking our bows on the stage. We called it the Cube of Herod.
I noticed the cube character and was going to ask because, to your point, Trevor, the film doesn't feel like it's trying to emphasize the 80s. If you're going to the thrift store, your stuff in your apartment is going to be older, and costume is always a mix of what people were wearing. And but the play does give that opportunity, and that character hopped out. So the so that's your writing partner in that cube on
Yeah,
stage.
I'm glad that he popped for you. Kind of hard to miss the giant Rubik's Cube. We figured that would be a good cameo for him.
Well, you also, or rather, I should say, Mr. Anderson then plays Pontius Pilate in a very Max Headroom inspired bit of video business as well.
Yes, it's the most indulgent thing. I was so scared that it was going to be just the most self-indulgent, in my own navel, kind of not funny, section of the movie. But in the end, I think it's a lot of people's favorite part of the movie. And I think a lot of that comes down to I worked with Lyle Bell, our composer, to write the original songs. And that guy, boy, he's a master of melody. He could give you a catchy earworm. You could give him a random Wikipedia entry and say, these are the lyrics, make it catchy. And he would give you something you'd walk out humming. So I think a lot of it has to do with the quality of those songs that Lyle Fish and I wrote ridiculous first thought, best thought lyrics, handed them off to Lyle, and he handed us back these killer tunes.
Stepping back from the play within the play, talk to me more about this sort of idea of people bringing their theater expertise to the filmmaking process. Now, some of the language is different, the intentions are different between film and theater. What kind of lessons were applicable to the execution of this film?
A character, nailing everything down to character and story. That's what translates. And so even our cinematographer, Wes Miron, studied originally as an actor in the same theater program that I went to. So he's approaching cinematography with an eye to character and an eye to story. And it as long as everybody's focused on that, like I was saying, even about these design choices, they're coming from character. And the character is influenced by the story. Who is the character, and what do they want, and what are they doing to get what they want? If you just stay focused on that, every decision is influenced by that. If you're at a loss, oh, where should I put the camera? If you start with, well, who's doing what and why, you're going to find out where to put the camera.
Well, whether it's a blessing or a curse, one thing that film does have that you don't get to enjoy on the stage is the opportunity to edit what you've done, as far as both supporting your story, doing a second take, but also having to make those choices. How is that a factor for you in this film?
Yeah, I would say, you've put your finger on probably the biggest difference. The two big differences between theater and film, I guess, are that, the proscenium arch of the live theater moves because it's the camera, it becomes the camera frame. And that was the biggest thing I had to learn moving from staging something for the stage. Like, for example, if you had a scene, this is just sort of off the top of my head. If you had a scene where two characters were out on a hike and they were supposed to play the scene while out on a hike in the theater, you'd block them to come in and take a rest. They'd hike their way into a styrofoam rock and they'd open up their thermos. How many times have we seen something like this? And you'd stage the conversation at this pause in the overall action of hiking. They'd need a rest. And then they'd carry on and leave the stage. But film, that would, if you do that in film, people are going to say, oh, the theater roots are showing. It's stagey. So you got to remember the proscenium arch is going to move with your characters. And so you probably, a more active way to shoot that might be to have them, hiking and talking, walk and talk. The opportunities for more dynamic blocking come with the camera replacing the proscenium arch. And then the other big thing is editing. Who did I recently see? I saw a clip of Frances McDormand talking about how she believes, like, at the end of the day, cinema is an editor's medium. And what she likes in a director is someone who can just give her the technical directions of, like, more momentum, or, you know, tone it down a little because it's not going to cut with. So she wants a director who knows how they're going to cut it and can help her pitch her performance for the edit. And I forwarded that clip to my longtime editor and great friend, Justin Lachance, who I've been lucky enough to work with since my third short film in 2008. We started working together, and that was in Edmonton. We had come up in the same rock and roll scene in Edmonton, because Edmonton is also a really good rock and roll town. And so we had been at a lot of the same gigs, had a lot of the same taste in music. He became my editor. He's bilingual, French and English, and he was living in the very Anglophone city of Edmonton. And his job was just cutting the French evening news. It's kind of the only gig he had in French. And so he said, you know, what am I doing here cutting the French evening news? I could move to the French province of Quebec and be working in actual cinema, French, Francophone cinema. And I was like, no, I found my editor. You're my editor and you're going to move. And this was 2008, so it wasn't as easy. We didn't have the technology yet. He said, well, there's this thing, it's called a telephone. And there's this other thing, it's called an airplane. It's going to be fine. And it was. And in fact, what he did was he got me introduced to a lot of the post-production people in Montreal, because he was living in Montreal, working in Montreal. I was going there to do the post-production on my short films. And that's how I got my relationship going with a lot of the terrific post-production people in Montreal. There's so much good post in Montreal. It was through Justin. So now I actually live in Montreal, because I got to the point where I looked so forward to going to Montreal to do the post-production, because there's such a vibrant cinema scene in Montreal, that I thought, well, why am I not doing my pre-production and my production in Montreal as well? So that's what I'm living here in Montreal now, giving that a go, even though my French is not what it should be as a Canadian, but I'm working on it. So those two things, the camera and the montage, are the biggest differences between live theater and cinema, I think.
Trevor, I want to ask you to apply those lessons, what you're able to do with the camera. And let's talk a little bit more about the ending of the film. There's this technical side of it, cutting between these multiple storylines as things sort of play out. And as a small spoiler, without giving away the story, you set this treehouse on fire.
It's a rocket ship, not a treehouse. I'm just quoting one of our characters when I say that. I'm not actually scolding you. The bully / love interest / best friend / bad influence, Carter, has to keep defending. It's a rocket ship, not a treehouse, to everybody.
Indeed. Yes.
Yeah, we do. Here's the big spoiler, is that at the end of the movie, Robin lights that rocket ship on fire and it burns down in the midst of a torrential rainstorm. So kudos to the crew, to the cinematographer and the gaffer who lit for fake fire that wasn't really there, to the VFX artists who gave us that fake fire, and to our key grip, Larry Kelly, who can do absolutely anything and who rigged us up some rain. I don't even know what the real ones are called. What do you call that on a professional film set? A rain rig? Well, you know, he gave us some big old movie sprinklers on a dime. So, you know, I think it's a surprise for people to see our hero suddenly end the movie with this action. I get asked about it, you know, in Q&As at film festivals. And my stock answer is, I like to say that I just want queer kids to know that arson is a legitimate way to deal with their feelings. But beyond that, I think at the beginning of the movie, Carter says to Robin, "What are you?" And what Carter means is, are you a boy or a girl? And then the movie never answers that question. This was the formal trick of the movie. Could we get away with raising the question but not answering it? Because I figured in 1987, Robin, 13 years old, Robin's not going to have language like we have now. Like now, maybe Robin could say, oh, I'm non-binary and my pronouns are they, them. And kids would move on with that knowledge. But in 1987, non-binary would have sounded like a computer word, you know? And I don't even want to say that Robin is non-binary, because I don't want the movie to know more than Robin. I think something's up with Robin's gender. Robin knows this. The kids around Robin know this, but nobody knows what. So nobody really talks about it beyond what are you? And then if that never quite gets answered, I thought, well, what happens if we leave all the gendered pronouns off screen? Certainly, this kid would be getting called gendered pronouns. This kid would be handed a gendered gym uniform. It would be something that was just in every moment of every day when people dealt with this kid. But that's the sort of twist of the movie, is what happens if the movie never looks at those moments? What happens if the script just finds sentence structures that allow us to never use him or her? And you don't even notice because a big deal is not made out of it. And a gender is never disclosed or determined for Robin. We never nail it down. It's always allowed to float and be ambiguous. So that was, formal trick number one, was what happens if we just skip the big reveal, the big traumatic reveal? And then what does that make room for? And the answer was, by the end of the movie, Robin turns the question back on Carter and says, "What are you?" Meaning, like, what kind of person are you? And Robin's implicated. Like, they've been doing some pretty lousy things. And so the question becomes not about are you a boy or a girl, but it's like, what kind of person are you? Are you a jerk? Like, that's sort of the question I want people to take away from the movie and be reminded that it's good to ask ourselves that question every once in a while. Check in on how are we doing on the am I a jerk scale. But then I look the same way Robin's gender is never nailed down as an easy answer. I didn't want it to be an ABC after school special about bullying where Robin learns a lesson and is a good kid and doesn't bully. So I thought, well, Robin's going to have all these feelings of guilt and confusion. And, maybe in 20 years with the right therapist, Robin's going to be able to talk about what they're feeling. But in the moment, Robin's maybe just going to go burn down the rocket ship. So for me, it becomes a loss of innocence. If the rocket ship, which is a treehouse, gets burned down, it's the end of childhood, But and it's also not just a simple binary, Robin's a good kid, Robin's a bad kid. Like Robin wants to be a good kid, but has done some lousy things and deals with those feelings by burning down this big wooden structure out in the woods. It also gave me a big visual ending.
Indeed. Well, to your point, I think it carries back through the entire film, Trevor. This idea of not making a point really leaves open for the issue to be real in a way that I think would have been lost with a different script. And I congratulate you. I think it was really successfully done.
Thanks. Thank you. I remember my adolescence as being a time full of questions I didn't have the answers for. Sort of back to that moment of wanting to make a film and not knowing where to start. It's the same feeling of I don't even know what my questions are, but I know I don't have the answers. And you just wait and you still have to get through grade eight. And so that's what we thought. Well, if we don't make this an issue movie, then we get maybe a chance to. The same way Robin doesn't have an answer to are you a boy or a girl, we tried to look for what are the other things about every character that don't have a simple answer, Like Tony's working in a Chinese restaurant and Robin says, "If you're Chinese, why is your name Tony?" And Tony just says, "Oh, I'm not Chinese." But then we never get into, okay, well then what are you? What are you is a question that we wanted to be able to be asked of all of the characters. The single dad, the secretaries are trying to set him up with a delivery girl from the courier, and he's not into it. And one of them says, "Are you a gay?" And he doesn't answer it. He just says, "I'm not interested in dating anyone right now." So there's this hovering question around Daniel, who does later go on a date with a woman, but doesn't go well. So I think we wanted there to be floating questions around all of the characters in an attempt to make them all more three-dimensional.
Well, I hope more people take the opportunity to see the film, Trevor. On that note, we're going to call it a wrap. Really great having you here.
Hey, it was a real pleasure. Thanks.
Listeners, I always appreciate your feedback. You'll find my contact info at our website, blowtheline1word.biz. That's BIZ. You'll also find past episodes and links to all of our social media, so check it out. Trevor, what's next for you?
Oh, well, that'll depend on the funders. But what I'm hoping is next is my writing partner, Fish, and I have written another feature film. It's called Goodbye Forever, and it's set in Montreal, this time in 1995. We're moving forward decade by decade. Yeah, and it tells two stories in parallel. The quick way to say what it's about is two Montreal strangers changed each other's lives without ever meeting.
I'm intrigued. Trevor, I hope it comes together.
Thanks, me too.
My closing credits, thanks to Curtis Five for our music, John Wan for our logo, and to all of our listeners, I appreciate you. The Below the Line logo is available on t-shirts, mugs, and stickers at redbubble.com. Please rate us wherever you get your podcasts and tell your friends. Thanks again from Below the Line.
Awesome.